Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 26th of November, these are our main stories. A court in Argentina has sentenced two Catholic priests to prison for sexually abusing children at a school for the deaf. The official committee investigating drugs in sport calls for Russia to be banned from all international competitions. Leaders in France and South Africa have announced plans to curb violence against women. Also in this podcast, a new report by the World Meteorological Society has said greenhouse gas levels have risen yet again. And a village in Nigeria gets fed up with its name.
One man said he'd put off meeting his girlfriend's parents because he was too embarrassed to tell them where he was from.
Why people in Area of Idiots were ready for a change. In a case that has made headlines across Argentina, two Catholic priests have been sentenced to prison for sexually abusing deaf children. A court gave them each more than 40 years behind bars.
Condenar a Horacio Hugo Corbacho Blanc a la pena.
The two clerics, Horacio Corbacho and Nicola Corradi, were found guilty of raping children over a 12-year period at the school. About 10 of their victims were in court for sentencing. I spoke to Veronica Smink of BBC Mundo.
It's hard to imagine a worse scenario. We're talking about children who not only were children, but also, you know, they couldn't communicate. It was just so terrible for them. The system, you know, that they were teaching them, the system for the deaf, didn't allow sign language. So the smaller children couldn't communicate with their parents at all. There have been horrible stories coming out from the victims, some saying that, you know, they were abused at night and that these priests had them take their hearing aids off, you know, so they couldn't hear the children scream. Just horrific, horrific stories.
So one of the priests, Nicola Corradi, had previously been accused of similar offences at a school in Italy.
That's right. 10 years back, there were victims from the Provolo Institute in Verona, the original Provolo Institute. And he was, Nicola Corradi, was amongst a group of priests accused of abuses there. The Italian justice couldn't do anything about it because the case expired. Too much time had passed since the accusations came forward. But some of these victims did tell the Vatican. One of them even met Pope Francis personally and gave him a letter, including, you know, the names of these priests, Nicola Corradi being one of them. Yet the Vatican reacted very late. They only sent out an investigation in 2017, 1 year after the Argentine authorities had already closed the institute in the province of Mendoza in Argentina.
Of course, Pope Francis is from Argentina, but we've heard all too many of this kind of case connected with the Catholic Church around the world. Where does this leave the reputation of the Catholic Church in Argentina?
A lot of people here are very, very disappointed with how the Vatican has acted, and they personally accuse Pope Francis of not listening to the victims of the Italian Institute. They say all of this could have been prevented. Let's also remember that it's not only the case of this institute in Mendoza, but this priest, Nicola Corradi, before arriving at this institute, had also worked, directed another institute in Buenos Aires province. And the Argentine authorities are also investigating abuses he and others committed there. So this case doesn't even end there. They're also very disappointed with Pope Francis having visited Chile a few years back and not visiting the victims in Mendoza and not even mentioning them, not one mention of them.
Veronica Smink from BBC Mundo. The official committee investigating drugs in sport has called for Russia to be banned from all international competitions for 4 years. The recommendation by the World Anti-Doping Agency comes after it found out that Russian officials had falsified laboratory data given to investigators. The ban would see next year's Olympics taking place without Russia. Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick told me more.
Well, this all relates to that big scandal which was uncovered, the first reports of it in 2015, and eventually it led to allegations of a state-sponsored and systematic doping conspiracy in Russia. Russia was banned from various sports. It missed out on the Pyeongchang 2018 Olympic Games. But then in September last year, WADA lifted its own ban on its anti-doping program. But there were conditions, and one of the conditions was that they should hand over electronic data. This is drug testing data from a Moscow laboratory which had been kept under lock and key. Now, they eventually got hold of that data in January this year, and experts have been analysing it, and they found it, or some of it, not to be authentic. In effect, what they have discovered is that Russian officials have been covering up positive tests, which is what they were trying to do in that scandal between 2012 and 2015. So they have broken the conditions, one of the conditions that was laid down for the lifting of the ban, and that's why this independent panel has called for Russia or RUSADA to be made non-compliant. And the sanctions for that, they're saying, should be a four-year ban. And a four-year ban in this case from all major sporting events.
So what are the chances of such a ban being implemented?
Well, this will be up for discussion on December the 9th when WADA's leadership, its executive committee led by Sir Craig Reedy, who is the outgoing president of WADA, they'll meet to discuss that, this issue. They will come to a decision. WADA is divided between sporting representatives from the IOC and government representatives. The IOC has in the past been quite reluctant to ban Russia as a nation. Thomas Bach, the IOC president, has always talked about protecting clean athletes. So there may be a bit of resistance to a ban, but it would be unusual, unlikely, I think, for WADA to reject this recommendation. More likely they'll accept it, and then it's likely that Russia will appeal that decision and it will go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So some way to go yet to reach a conclusion in this, but it doesn't look good for Russia as it stands, and another step towards them not being allowed to take part in these major sporting events.
Alex Capstick. The figures are staggering. One third of all women and girls experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. Half of all women killed in the world die at the hands of their partners or families. The United Nations released these statistics on Monday to coincide with the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. In France, where over the weekend thousands of women demonstrated against gender-based violence, the government has proposed a raft of policies intended to prevent domestic abuse. Our correspondent in Paris, Lucy Williamson, sent this report.
A report by the Justice Ministry last month found that almost half of those killed by their partners had previously filed a report with the police, but that 80% of the complaints did not lead to prosecution. Today, after 2 months of government consultations, the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, responded.
A proposal will enter into Parliament in January 2020 for the automatic suspension of parental authority for any partner who kills their companion, and the option of judicial restrictions to parental authority for violent partners.
The government also said it'll create 1,000 extra spaces in emergency shelters, train police officers in how to assess complaints, and has suggested that doctors will be able to break patient confidentiality in cases of domestic violence if they think it would save lives. It's also said it will co-fund new care centres in each region of France for the perpetrators themselves. The Rosati home is currently one of very few centres to help violent partners to change. The men who stay here for the four-week programme have mostly been convicted of domestic violence in some form. Money for schemes like this is controversial, but the home's director, Benoît Durieux, says it works.
We have a reoffending rate of around 10%. In the absence of any follow-up, it's more than 40%. Our hope is that the victims of domestic violence understand that it's possible to free themselves from the yoke of an abusive man, and the perpetrators can also understand that they can act differently.
At the march here over the weekend, there were mixed feelings about how effective the government measures would be. "Count on me to mobilise the whole nation," President Macron tweeted. But will it stem the growing list of women who found no one they could count on?
Lucy Williamson. The South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, marked the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women by saying the targeting of women had become a great shame on the country. Last year, more than 2,700 women were murdered in South Africa, and every day more than 100 cases of rape are reported. Mr. Ramaphosa vowed to crack down on gender-based violence with a campaign to change attitudes and behaviour and increase access to justice for survivors. Nompsa Maseko is our correspondent in Johannesburg. She told me more about this campaign.
There was a university student, 21-year-old Precious Ramabulane. She was stabbed 52 times, this is according to the police, and raped. And we understand from the police that she was asleep in her room. She's renting a room in a township in the north of the country when an unknown man gained entry through the window and raped her, assaulted her and killed her. And we understand also from the neighbors that her screams woke up a lot of people in the area, because this happened at around 2:30 in the morning, in the early hours of the morning. And that is how people were alerted to the crime, who then phoned the police. But as they got to her room, she was laying in a pool of blood and she was dead on the scene. And of course, this campaign by the president comes literally hours after this yet another gruesome attack on a South African woman. And a lot of activists are saying that this needs a state of emergency and not the kind of reaction that the president is giving the country.
Yeah, these numbers are just extraordinary. 7 women a day murdered, 100 rapes being reported each day. Just tell us how this campaign will work.
Well, this is an annual campaign. It's actually called 16 Days of Activism Against Women and Children Abuse. This happens every year, where the government, every year in November at around this time, for 16 days, they have this campaign where there's awareness on this issue. But from crime statistics that have been revealed earlier this year, that were released, and they show that rape and murder cases, particularly murders of women in South Africa, are on the increase. And we heard earlier, of course, from the president saying he's launching a $100 million campaign to end femicide in the country. But a lot of activists, a lot of women in South Africa are saying it is not enough. Women in South Africa are scared to even walk around the streets. But also alarmingly, the fact that these attacks don't just happen at the hands of strangers, but some of these attacks happen at home. And women in South Africa are saying that they have nowhere to run to.
Nompsa Maseko. Scientists have warned that concentrations of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere have reached another record high, further fueling climate change. The World Meteorological Organization, part of the United Nations, reported that human activity is to blame. Justin Rowlett is our chief environment correspondent. Earlier, he spoke to my colleague Divya Arya.
What we're learning from the World Meteorological Organization is that the concentrations of greenhouse gases have risen yet again. Importantly, they actually seem to be accelerating, and this comes against a backdrop, of course, of awareness around the world, growing awareness around the world of how serious this problem is. So what are we actually talking about here? Well, we're talking primarily about carbon dioxide. This is a gas that traps heat from the sun in the atmosphere. That's why it's called a global warming gas, so trapping heat. There's also methane, nitrous oxide. There are all sorts of other gases, more rarer gases. But the point about these gases is the concentration is rising, and if you've got a greater concentration, you can store more heat in the atmosphere, and that is what is causing climate change. That's what's causing global warming around the world, and the more concentration of greenhouse gases we get, the worse the effects of global warming we can expect. So it is not good news for the world that this is happening.
But I wonder if it is surprising news at all.
It isn't surprising news, because this has happened every year since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But what we were hoping was that as the world becomes more aware of it, we'd begin to tackle the problem. How do we tackle the problem? We've got to emit less of these gases. It means switching from fossil fuels to renewables, for example, wherever we can. Maybe changing your car from a petrol or diesel car to hopefully changing it one day to an electric car using electricity generated by a wind turbine or perhaps a solar panel somewhere. That's what we're hoping will begin to happen. That's what the UN's been working for years with a whole series of climate conferences, trying to get the world together, trying to take action on this, cut emissions. What these figures are telling us is, at the moment, certainly it is not working.
Justin Rowlatt speaking to Divya Iyer. Now, as Justin alluded, some of the world's most powerful governments have pledged at various points to take meaningful action against rising levels of greenhouse gases. But for the most part, they failed to follow through. Here's our environment analyst, Roger Harabin.
Our modern world was created by fossil fuels. They heat our homes, cook our dinners, move our cars, power our industries. With all the vested interests accrued over a couple of centuries, it's not surprising they are hard to give up. There are signs of change, but the effort needs to be global, and the former UK chief scientist Sir David King laments a lack of political will.
Up to 2010, we had tremendous leadership from the British government, followed by the German government. And then, briefly, Obama provided leadership. But today, who is providing that leadership on the world stage?
Not President Trump. He's actively promoting fossil fuels. Not Australia, which subsidised a giant coal mine as freak wildfires swept the land. China appeared to step up when Premier Xi Jinping banned new coal developments to stop pollution and greenhouse gases. It didn't last. Provincial governors said millions of poor households were left in the cold. Coal-fired power stations are being built again in China. But the picture is mixed and the future uncertain. A report by three international energy experts noted the largest global fall in electricity production from coal on record. Much of the slack's being taken up by renewables, whose costs have plunged much faster than even their most ardent advocates dreamed possible. The key question, is the turnaround happening in time to stave off major climatic disruption? Of that, we are not yet sure.
Roger Harabin. Still to come in this podcast, Israel deports a human rights worker over accusations that he promoted boycotts of the country. And Hong Kong's council elections were a landslide victory for the pro-democracy movement, but many say their work is far from over.
When we look at the state media, they don't seem willing to accept the result. The protests on the street should continue, as we haven't seen a systematic change in the government.
After weeks of will he or won't he speculation, Michael Bloomberg has joined the race to win the US Democratic Party's nomination to run for president. The former mayor of New York City officially began his campaign on Monday with a speech that took aim at the current president, Donald Trump.
Today, I'm glad to announce that I am running for president to defeat Donald Trump and to unite and rebuild America. We cannot afford four more years of President Trump's reckless and unethical actions. He is an existential threat to our country, to our values, and our national security.
Our correspondent, Neda Torfik, is in New York. I asked her how likely it is that Mr. Bloomberg can win the Democratic nomination.
You know, Michael Bloomberg is polling very low at about 1% at the moment. And even though he was the former mayor of America's largest city, he still has really low name recognition across the nation. And so what he's done is he's now embarked on the single largest advertising buy in history. He's spending $30 million in TV ads in a single week to really try to introduce himself to voters, to kind of show them that he, besides his political experience and his business interests, he also is a philanthropist who has tried to contribute to a lot of progressive issues like gun control and healthcare and climate change. That's really his main pitch, along with the fact that he thinks that Donald Trump needs to be defeated and the current Democratic candidates aren't up to the challenge. So he is going to face a bit of an uphill battle, though, because he is skipping the four early states, instead trying to focus on what we call Super Tuesday, the states that vote in March. So that is an interesting strategy that has never been tried before, but we've seen, in the past politics be a bit surprising.
Will he be allowed to take part in the Democrat TV debates?
You know, interestingly, he won't unless the Democratic National Committee changes the rules. At the moment, he is self-funding his campaign, which means he's not taking any donations from grassroots sources. And the rules for appearing in debates means you have to. Now, he says he doesn't want to be swayed by special interests, but a lot of progressives are attacking him, saying that he's essentially trying to buy this election, that that's not the way you get to the presidency. You have to go out and speak to voters and win their support in a more organic fashion. So I think this is going to be really interesting because Michael Bloomberg, of course, also has a long record on which he's running. And progressives have also attacked him on his record as mayor, promoting what people saw as a racist policing policy called Stop and Frisk, where many African and Latino men were stopped. And a federal court actually ruled that that was unconstitutional. And it wasn't really until Michael Bloomberg was pretty certain that he was going to announce his run that he finally apologized for that policy. So that's another point that many people are criticizing him on.
Neda Torfik. Israel has deported a Human Rights Watch employee accused of supporting a boycott of the country. Omar Shakir's work visa was declined for renewal in May last year on the grounds that he tweeted and shared online content opposing Israel. Barbara Platt-Usher reports from Jerusalem.
Human Rights Watch officials said Israel's decision to deport Omar Shakir was part of a broader attempt to shut down criticism of Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. They said Israel has now joined a club of countries such as North Korea, Venezuela, and Iran that have expelled the group's employees. The Israeli authorities issued a statement accusing Mr. Shakir of promoting boycotts against the country, which is against the law here, but they rejected requests for interviews. Human Rights Watch says it doesn't endorse a boycott of Israel. Rather, it urges businesses not to work with the settlements because they are illegal under international law.
Barbara Platt-Usher. After months of protests, the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong has won a major victory in local elections. Pro-democracy candidates took almost 90% of the seats on district councils in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. For many, it's an achievement worth celebrating, but with Beijing casting aspersions about the legitimacy of the vote, some citizens of Hong Kong remain wary.
For the future life of the protester, if it goes well and if the government replied it well, then I think the protests will just go down like peacefully. Otherwise, it's just going to go up. Like, it all depends on how the government going to reply.
Obviously, we have shown our dissatisfaction to the government through the system. Yet, when we look at the state media, they don't seem willing to accept the result. Therefore, I think the protests on the street should continue, as we haven't seen a systematic change in the government.
Our China media analyst Kerry Allen told me more about the reaction by officials in mainland China.
They're not pleased whatsoever, and they didn't appear to be expecting this. So some of the coverage that I've seen today coming out of official media like People's Daily and CCTV are saying there's still more work to be done. And they're suggesting that there's more people who are violent than they thought, because going back to June, when these demonstrations began in Hong Kong, the official media in mainland China were putting out the idea that all of the demonstrators were rioters, they were hooligans. So there's concern coming out of official media, and there are some particularly strong lines from some papers saying that it was Western influence that has led to this result. So the suggestion that Western governments have influenced violence in the region.
But people in mainland China are aware that something's happened.
Yeah, they're talking about this today. They're also showing papers from Hong Kong, but we have to bear in mind that Hong Kong has a very different media environment to mainland China. So there are independent papers and there are also pro-Beijing papers. But people in mainland China can't access independent papers because China has what's known as the Great Firewall, and it censors independent results to only show its message. So people who wanted an idea of what people in Hong Kong might be seeing are only seeing one side of the story. And they're seeing, for example, papers like Ta Kung Pao and Wen Wei Po, these are pro-Beijing papers, that are saying that this election was rigged. So they're putting out some very strong lines suggesting that demonstrators on the ground were actually affecting the results. So one example was that demonstrators were walking up to elderly people and confusing them to vote the other way. And also they were spreading rumours online to convince people to vote pro-democracy as opposed to pro-Beijing. But also China has what's known as the 50 cent party, who are people who are paid 50 cents, a very small amount of money, by the government to post messages in line with the government's message. So a lot of the comments that I'm seeing that have particularly a lot of likes and are forced to the top of the rankings are ones that say, end Hong Kong violence. These demonstrators, again, are terrorists and hooligans. So very much in line with what Beijing wants.
Kerry Allen. India's official statistics office has released data showing that nearly 30% of households in rural parts of the country don't have access to toilets. That report contradicts the government's own claims. From Mumbai, here's Yogita Limaye.
Ensuring that every home has access to a toilet has been a key priority for Prime Minister Narendra Modi since he first came to power in 2014. This year in October, he announced that the country's villages had achieved that goal. Rural India and the people who live there have declared themselves open defecation free, he said in a speech in front of tens of thousands of people. Now, a report from his own government statistics office contradicts that claim. A survey conducted from July to December last year found that more than a quarter of families in India's villages don't have access to a toilet, even a community one. The government has yet to respond to the report. And while the discrepancy is being questioned, the data does show a significant increase in the number of rural households that do have access to toilets now, twice as many as there were since the last time the survey was conducted in 2012.
Yogita Limaye with that report. There's Batman in Turkey, Condom in France, and nowhere else in Australia. Cities and towns with names that some residents may prefer to change. Villagers in Area of Idiots in northern Nigeria couldn't take the humiliation anymore, and so they've swapped their local moniker for Area of Plenty. Our Africa editor Mary Harper takes up the story.
The local emir, Ibrahim Abubakar, announced the name change after residents of the Area of Idiots, as it was called in the Hausa language, complained that they'd been mocked for years and subjected to all sorts of cruel jokes. They were ashamed to tell people where they came from. There have been celebrations in the renamed village, with people from other parts of Kano State coming to join the party. One man said he'd put off meeting his girlfriend's parents because he was too embarrassed to tell them where he was from. Now I can proudly tell them I'm from the Area of Plenty, he said. Another resident thanked the emir for bringing to a close the years of ridicule and mocking laughter the villagers had endured. The village gained its original name about 70 years ago when people settled close to a river known as Idiotic River. A local chief said he had no idea why the river has that name.
Mary Harper. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.